Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. More than 12,000 firefighters are battling 17 active fires across California. Yesterday, firefighters from Australia and New Zealand arrived in the United States to help fight fires in California. Since June, the fires have killed 8 people, burned close to 500,000 acres, and damaged or destroyed over 2,000 structures. Over 16,000 homes are threatened by the fires, and nearly 40,000 residents are under evacuation. A pair of massive wildfires on both sides of Clear Lake, which is about 100 miles north of San Francisco, have burned more than 273,000 acres, becoming one of the largest fires in California's history and the most pressing of the 17 fires across the state. Scott McLean, a deputy chief with the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, said, quote, "Look how big it got just in a matter of days. Look how fast this Mendocino complex went up in ranking. That doesn't happen. That just doesn't happen," end quote. The intensity and the frequency of these fires has been contributed to record level heat, extended drought conditions, dry vegetation, and dead trees. Record level temperatures and massive fires are not limited to the state of California. Greece, Sweden, Norway, Latvia, and Ireland have also been devastated by fires this summer because of high temperatures and less rainfall. So how is climate change fueling these wildfires? To explore all of these issues, we are joined today by two guests. Kathy Dello is Associate Director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute at Oregon State University, and she joins us from her office in Corvallis, Oregon. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. Thank you. And Daniel Swain is an atmospheric scientist at the University of California, Los Angeles. And Daniel joins us from his office in Los Angeles. Hi, Daniel. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. In recent weeks, we have seen major fires burning large swaths of land in California. I mentioned a couple of them in the intro. There's also the Ferguson fire on the edge of Yosemite that's been burning since July 13th. I mean, these fires are getting a lot of attention, and experts say this is very early in the season for so many fires to be burning at the same time. Daniel, do you think we truly understand the magnitude of what is happening and why?
Well, I think what you just said in the introduction is essentially the main reason why what's going on right now is so remarkable, that we have multiple fires that are on the order of 100,000 acres or more right now in California, burning at a time of year that actually isn't the peak of fire season here. Usually that comes later in the year, in the early autumn, when our offshore winds and temperatures tend to peak. So this is sort of not great to be seeing this sort of peak fire season activity not during the peak season.
Hmm. Kathy, what would you add?
Yeah, so just over the border here in Oregon, we have a bunch of fires burning as well. And like Daniel said, we wouldn't expect fire season to kick off so early. It was really around July 4th when we saw these fires take off. And it's not just damage to our forests, but a lot of our wheat crop has been decimated by some of these early fires.
Kathy, give us a sense of what's happening in Oregon. And what's different about the fires this year?
Well, it's very similar to California. We came off a year with a winter with pretty normal precipitation, but lousy snowpack. And then things really dried out in May and heated up. We've had this just stretch of really hot and dry weather, which the conditions are prime for these fires to take off. So whether it's lightning that causes them or humans, the conditions are there on the ground. So it's really similar to what you're seeing in California. Fortunately for us, many of our fires have remained away from urban areas. You had the Carr fire very close to Redding, but still it's impacting all sorts of recreation, people visiting small towns. Smoke has been a problem in the past few weeks. It's just not a great scene.
Hi, sorry about that. So I'm hosting some KRCB and Rohnert Park this week, and we just lost power. So I'm going to join you on the phone until we get our power back. Can you both hear me okay?
Yes.
Barely.
Okay, great. And sorry to listeners, I hope that this sounds okay, but we're going to try to fix the power on our end. So Kathy, why don't we continue? What really strikes you the most about the ongoing fires? One thing that's getting a lot of attention is just how hot it is. The weather is just extremely hot.
Yeah, so when we look at the past 5 years of summers in both Oregon and California, they rank in the top 10. We've had these just really hot and dry summers, which we know would happen with climate change, and really we're seeing it play out on the landscape. Climate change is here. So the conditions are perfect for these fires to burn hotter, bigger, longer, and coupled with drought conditions on the ground and other impacts from smoke, this seems to be what our summers are looking like more often than not.
And I would add, you know, that the essentially what we've been seeing, not just in California but elsewhere as well, is that the common thread in all of these places that are experiencing severe fires is that it has been really, really warm, much warmer than average, and in many cases, record warm. And that's been sort of true cutting across places that saw average precipitation or below average precipitation, or even, interestingly, if we think back just to last year in California, above average precipitation. And yet, across all of these different precipitation conditions, temperatures recently have been warm enough to sort of overwhelm the effect of precipitation in a lot of places. So last autumn, for example, we saw record dryness of the vegetation in parts of California immediately preceding the Santa Rosa fires, for example. And that immediately followed the wettest winter on record in that part of the state. But it was also followed by the warmest summer on record in that part of the state. And so that's sort of what we're seeing, is that the temperature signal is really dominating. And this winter in California, we sort of had a bit of both. It was somewhat dry and somewhat warm, but now this summer has once again been extraordinarily warm. And so we're seeing this explosively dry vegetation that is very receptive to any sort of spark that's generated, whether it's a flat tire with a rim of the wheel grinding along the pavement, as the case was in the car fire, apparently, or whether it's a lightning strike, which has caused a couple of the fires up in the Sierra Nevada right now. It doesn't really matter where the spark comes from. The fuels right now, the vegetation is in a state of dryness where it's just ready to burn explosively, given a spark. But I think the reason why these fires have been so difficult to fight is partly because of, well, there's several factors sort of at play, and this is sort of what the conversation on these fires has been centering around recently, is that there is the backdrop and the very long term of the fact that we have essentially put more people in harm's way. We have more people living in the what's known as the wildland-urban interface. So essentially we have urban and suburban encroachment into wildland areas that have lots of natural vegetation that is potentially at high risk of wildfire. So we're increasing the risk by moving into the high-risk zones, and that's happened increasingly over decades. But what we're also seeing in California is that the character of the fires that are burning has changed. And this is something that you can really get at when you talk to CAL FIRE folks or folks who are actually on the ground fighting these fires. What we've seen this summer, and really for the last 5 or so years in California, are wildfires that are behaving differently than they used to. They are moving much faster. They are escaping initial control more easily. They're burning hotter. They're exhibiting some really extreme behavior. And we've seen some especially dramatic examples of that in the past week in California, where, for example, the Mendocino Complex fires, which is composed of both the Ranch Fire and the River Fire, has gone from just a small spot fire east of Ukiah to becoming what may, by the end of the day or by tomorrow, end up being the largest complex of wildfires in California state history. Just last week, near the city of Redding, we saw what was essentially a fire tornado, and I don't say that lightly. Typically, when we talk about fires generating their own extreme weather conditions, we're talking about generating strong breezes or large smoke clouds that can cause swirling winds. But in this case, the fire itself really generated a storm over the city of Redding that produced what was, in effect, a tornado. In fact, it was so strong, it was actually what could probably be considered the strongest tornado-like feature in California history, and it was generated by a wildfire in July in the city of Redding. So that gives some indication of just how extreme the fire behavior has been recently in California.
And Daniel, we're back again, so thank you for bearing with us. You were quoted in an LA Times article about that, and the article says, quote, as authorities sifted the rubble from the fire that burned more than 1,000 residences in Shasta County, they were startled by what they encountered. A soaring transmission tower was tipped over, tiles were torn off the roofs of homes, massive trees were uprooted, vehicles removed. In one spot, a fence post was bent around a tree with the bark on one side sheared off, end quote. I mean, this video got shared on Facebook a number of times because it was just so surreal.
Yeah, it really was kind of a surreal event, I think, certainly for the people who lived through it and who literally were running and driving for their lives when it was occurring, and also for people who study wildfire and meteorology. I mean, it was certainly the best documented example of what's called a large fire vortex that I think that we've really ever had in the U.S., and it may have actually been one of the stronger ones. I mean, it was just this locally devastating event, and it really must have been pretty terrifying to be on the ground, because these sorts of, this was essentially a fire-generated storm that was producing its own damage in its own right. Even in the unburned areas, there was significant damage from this fire-generated storm. So I would agree that's sort of flabbergasting.
That's the word I'm seeing in a lot of stories, Kathy, is it seems like so many scientists and, you know, people like yourself, I mean, you're the associate director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute, are somewhat shocked at what they're seeing by the speed with which these fires are spreading, the extreme heat, the tornado that Daniel was just talking about. I mean, how long have you been covering fires and researching fires, and what shocks you about this? Is this our new norm?
So I've been researching Western climate for about a decade now, and this is an interesting time for people at my career stage, because we've been studying climate change now for 30 years, back to Jim Hansen's testimony that we need to do something about it. But also, we've been talking about this as a future problem for so long and so long, but we're actually seeing climate change play out here, and it does manage to shock us. This is what we've known was coming. We knew we had to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, or we would see this sort of destruction. We would see these hazards increase. We knew wildfires were getting worse and were going to get worse, but these things still managed to amaze us. The fire whirl, fire tornado, whatever we're calling it, that Daniel just spoke to, blew me away. It's amazing that not only are we seeing just this widespread destruction from things burning, but also trees ripped out of the ground and structures damaged. You see the fires and the photos in the news, and it's still shocking, and it really shocks me how close these things are getting to urban areas. So yeah, I mean, we study these things, we anticipate these things, but those of us who do this day in and day out are still shocked when we see these high temperatures and big fires.
Kathy Dello is Associate Director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute at Oregon State University, and Daniel Swain is an atmospheric scientist at the University of California, Los Angeles. And today we are talking about the massive wildfires that we are seeing in California. As Kathy said, there's wildfires in Oregon. We're talking about why this is happening. This is early in the season, and there has been so much destruction. It is very, very hot. If you have any questions about the fires that we're seeing, we'd love to hear from you. If you're affected by this, if you have been affected by this, we covered the awful Sonoma and Napa County fires last year, and unfortunately, a lot of people have to relive that trauma. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Well, as you mentioned, Kathy, people have been studying this for 30 decades. James Hansen's testimony is getting a lot of attention. And we always say, what if we would have taken measures back then? Of course, unfortunately, we'll never know. But Daniel, why don't we take a look back at what has happened over the past 30 years? According to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the world's annual temperature has warmed nearly 1 degree over 30 years. The temperature in the U.S. has gone up even more, nearly 1.6 degrees. So how do these changes in temperature affect what we're seeing in California?
Well, sort of as Kathy mentioned, I think one of the key points is that we've reached a point now in the sort of the history of global warming where a lot of the things that were predictions 20, 30 years ago, and some things even that were predictions just a decade ago, have started to enter the realm of our observed reality. So in other words, today we are seeing in the real world all around us things happening that were predicted several decades ago. And we first saw that, obviously, with global mean temperature, where the most central prediction of global warming science was essentially that the global average temperature would increase. Obviously, that has occurred, and the amount by which it's increased is largely in line with expectations from decades ago. But now, more recently, really within the last 5-10 years or so, a couple things have happened, both in the real world and in the scientific arena, that have allowed us essentially new insights into other sorts of events. So looking beyond just the global average temperature, looking at things like the increasing frequency and intensity of heat waves or of intense downpours of rain. These sorts of extreme events that had been long projected to increase, but there had been less evidence that they actually had in the real world until somewhat recently. We've now seen enough of them in the last 5 to 10 years that's starting to change. We're now starting to see meaningful and significant increases in certain kinds of extreme weather events associated with global warming. And the first of these essentially to emerge in a way that scientists are becoming increasingly confident in talking about essentially are extreme heat and extreme downpours. And right now, out west, we're really sort of suffering the consequences of the former, of the extreme heat. And what we're seeing is that even though we've only warmed about a degree globally so far, that the impacts with respect to other sorts of events, these extreme heat and precipitation events, for example, is quite substantial. So you can imagine that if we continue to go down that path and warm an additional 3, 4, or even 5 degrees, that the kinds of impacts we're talking about, if we go that far down the line, are really quite dramatic.
Daniel Swain is an atmospheric scientist at the University of California, Los Angeles. Kathy Dello is Associate Director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute at Oregon State University. And Kathy, the New York Times had a piece that's getting a lot of attention in the Sunday magazine called "How Did the End of the World Become Old News?" Actually, that was a New York magazine piece. But the New York Times piece says that the Paris Climate Agreement hoped to restrict warming to 2 degrees. The odds of succeeding, according to a recent study based on current emission trends, are 1 in 20. If by some miracle we are able to limit warming to 2 degrees, we will only have to negotiate the extinction of the world's tropical reefs, sea level rise of several meters, and the abandonment of the Persian Gulf. The climate scientist James Hansen has called a 2-degree warming a prescription for long-term disaster. Disaster is now the best case scenario. Do you agree with that? What do you think about that statement?
Yeah, so 2 degrees is going to be tough, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try. We bought into a certain amount of warming already because of the way that greenhouse gases remain in the atmosphere, so the next few decades will continue to warm. What we're doing now, what we're trying to take action now, is for future generations, for our kids and our grandchildren, who will have to live on a completely different planet than the one we're living on now. Just a few minutes ago, you mentioned the new normal, but a bunch of us are pushing back on that because it can and it will get much worse from here if we leave climate change unchecked. So I actually haven't read the piece yet, but I've heard a lot about it, and the prospects are dim, and we know that climate change is happening. We know we're causing it. We know that we need to take action and reduce our greenhouse gas emissions to slow it down. But Daniel made a good point a few seconds ago that the globe is warming, but the impacts that we're seeing are really local ones. So we can talk about abandoning the Persian Gulf and coral reefs, and these are all really important things to focus on, because when you think of this, it's just one big globe and one big planet, and just 1 degree, it's not enough. So here in Oregon, in California, we're seeing the impacts of climate change. It's hurting us, and while it's going to take a global effort to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, there's still time for us to try.
And Daniel, before we go to break, just briefly, what would you add?
I would echo a lot of what Kathy just said and sort of emphasize that, you know, 2 degrees is going to be quite tough, and we are not currently on track to meet the threshold that we had hoped we might meet with the Paris Agreement. That's not just the U.S. That's from the global perspective. Collectively, as a global society, we are not on track to meet those Paris Agreement targets. But that said, while 2 degrees is going to be really tough, 3 degrees is going to be much worse than 2 degrees, and 4 or 5 degrees, which is still conceivably in the realm of possibility, if we don't really rein in our emissions, would be catastrophically worse than 2 degrees. So there is actually not just a meaningful difference between 2 degrees and a much higher level of warming, but I think sort of a fundamental, and in some cases, you know, for certain sorts of concerns, existential difference between 2 degrees and 4 or 5 degrees. So there, you know, and there's not like there's a magic guardrail at 2 degrees either. There's this notion, I think, that 2 degrees is in some way a tipping point where if we go past it, all hope is lost, and if we stay underneath it, that everything is going to be fine. And I think the reality is that neither of those two things are true. A lot of bad things will happen even at 2 degrees, but, you know, 2.5 degrees is going to still be a heck of a lot better than 3 degrees and, you know, isn't catastrophically different from 2. More is worse, so there's always going to be very strong motivation to shave off as much as we can off the sort of the upper end warming scenarios by reducing those carbon emissions as much as we possibly can, as quickly as we possibly can.
Daniel Swain is an atmospheric scientist at the University of California, Los Angeles, and Kathy Dello is associate director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute at Oregon State University. On today's Your Call, it's our One Planet series, and we are talking about the devastating fires in the West. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about false news spreading online. According to a new study by MIT scholars, false news spreads far more rapidly on Twitter than real news. We're seeing the same thing on Facebook, and it's not due to bots. It's due to people sharing inaccurate news items. So what will it take to push social media companies like Twitter and Facebook to prioritize the truth over profits? We're also putting shows together about a new PBS documentary called Documenting Hate, Charlottesville. It looks at the white supremacists and the neo-Nazis involved in that rally, and it looks at how they still operate around the country. Maybe you can watch that film and then bring your questions to the table. We're also putting a show together about a new documentary called Crime and Punishment. It's about a class action lawsuit filed by Black and Latino whistleblowers, former police officers, who want to expose illegal policing quotas. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. Today it is our One Planet series, and we are focusing on the devastating fires that we're seeing along the West Coast. In California, more than 12,000 firefighters are battling 17 active fires. Firefighters from Australia and New Zealand just arrived in the United States to help fight those fires. We're talking about how climate change is fueling the fires with Kathy Dello, Associate Director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute at Oregon State, and Daniel Swain, an atmospheric scientist at the University of California, Los Angeles. And you can join us, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I don't want to get off the subject of fires, but I did want to just make a comment about climate change that your guests have brought up. I think things are going to get much worse before they get better, if they can get better. So that's one thing. So I think we're going to be dealing with this kind of thing going forward, absent some intervention that could prevent this. But let me just get back to the fires. What I'm concerned about is this. This has been going on for millennia, I guess, in this part of the country, maybe other parts of the world. Of course, so if we just concentrate on the last 40 or 50 years, we've been seeing this intensification going on with regard to the fires. And I'm really wondering what happened with the state's efforts to try to engage in preventive measures that might have ameliorated some of this. I know that I used to see, when I go to Yosemite, controlled burns being done up near Yosemite. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to have had much of an effect given what's going on there right now. So I don't know what happened over the last 20 years with regard to trying to deal with prevention. And then secondly, now that this is happening, what can be done, if anything, preventatively going forward? I mean, is there some approach to this that could lessen, I mean, because we're going to be stuck with this climate change thing for quite a while. What can
we do? Right, and it's just getting worse. Thank you, Greg. Daniel, do you want to take that one first?
Sure. So, you know, I think something that I've heard in my recent conversations with fire scientists and forest ecologists is that there's sort of a confluence of factors occurring right now, one of which is the sort of a long-term legacy in the forested regions of policies over the past century or so that inhibited natural fires and meant that we haven't seen over decades the kinds of sort of naturally cleansing low-intensity fires that burn out the understory, remove the smaller trees, but leave the large ones intact across the American West. And one of the consequences of that is that we essentially have forests in a lot of areas that are now unnaturally dense and prone to explosive fire. So there's the forest management component to that. The second thing that's happened is that the climate has gotten a lot warmer, and a lot of that has actually transpired over the last 20 to 30 years. So that's sort of the time period that you mentioned. And so the two of these things together really amplify each other. The fact that we now have forests that are maybe not in their naturally optimal state in terms of their resilience to fire, and we have also changed the climate itself in a way that means that the forests are drier, that we have weather conditions that are more extreme and more conducive toward allowing fire to become established in these systems in the first place. So one of the challenges now is that there is definitely a role, as you mentioned, for controlled burning or letting some fires burn rather than trying to put them out right away and sort of control them in a strategic way and sort of to control where they go and keep them away from structures that allow them to have the benefits in the forest. But one of the challenges, and we do that, but one of the challenges now is that the forests are so drought-stressed and so dry and in some cases so dense from decades of the forest policy that we've had in place that it really isn't safe anymore to do these controlled burns under most circumstances. I mean, imagine being a fire manager in California this summer and proposing to the state, hey, you know what we should do? We should start some controlled burns now in the national forests. That wouldn't go over very well this year for obvious reasons. And this is one of the challenges, is we're just not getting breaks in it anymore. The fire season is occurring almost year-round now in California, and we're not really getting a reprieve to do the kinds of constructive risk mitigation that I think a lot of folks would like to be doing. It's just always on now, and there's really no opportunity to engage in that sort of thing.
So what does that mean exactly? What options are available to fire chiefs and firefighters? I mean, at a time when they're already so stretched, we're seeing photos of them sleeping on the ground wherever they can find space. These firefighters from New Zealand and Australia just arrived to help. And just in 1 month, the state of California has used 25% of the emergency fund to fight these fires.
Well, I mean, I think that there, you know, after the Santa Rosa fires last year, I think that triggered some conversations about, some deeper conversations about, the fact that a lot of people, not just in California, but really throughout the Western U.S., live in places that are at extremely high risk of fire under the right conditions. And we haven't really built our cities, and in some cases, our sort of emergency management infrastructure in a way that is really suited to accommodate those rapidly increasing risks, because it's not just a climate question, it's also an urban development question and a forest management question. And all of these things, unfortunately, have pushed in the same direction to increase risk in recent years, and we haven't really done a good job of comprehensively addressing it, partly because the solutions are on different scales for each one of the problems. From the forest management side, that's partly federal policy and partly regional and state policy. From the urban areas, that's largely local policy, and the climate question is essentially a global question, and it's not something that we can directly control ourselves. So it's really a multifactorial issue with no easy solutions, I think.
I can add to
our
that
power
a
went out
bit,
here.
Bend Oregon is one
again,
of the fastest growing
bear with me until we get it back.
West,
I'm on the phone
the
again.
Fastest.
Cassie, what would you add? And if
one
you can
of the
speak
most
up a little bit, I had a hard time
areas
hearing you before.
In the country, and we're not looking at things like building codes. We're putting the onus on individual homeowners and saying, well, clear out some defensible space, clear your brush, and this may make people feel more prepared than they actually are. We humans are terrible at planning for disasters. We react to them, but we don't get out ahead of them. And we really need to be looking at these community level, state level, I can't speak to what California is doing, strategies, because the fires aren't going away.
You know, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to try to get on a landline. Sorry about the technical issues. This is Your Call, and today we are talking about fires. Unfortunately, these fires are now almost year-round, and I'm going to try to get on a landline so the sound is better. We'll be back right after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. So sorry about the technical issues, but we keep losing power here. So I'm going to continue to try to host the show with my phone, and I'm really sorry about these technical issues. Today we are joined by Daniel Swain, atmospheric scientist at the University of California, Los Angeles, and Kathy Dello, associate director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute at Oregon State University. Kathy, I'm hoping that I can hear you, but can you finish your thought about, you know, what we are facing? I mean, Daniel says there are fire chiefs are really hitting a wall because what we're dealing with right now is year-round and it's so incredibly hot. So what options do firefighters have at this point?
Well, it's a broader question. We haven't talked much in this hour about adaptation or resiliency, and with some folks, they seem to think that it's us giving up on climate change, but really it's us dealing with the reality that we're in climate change, the new normal is shifting, and we're going to move past it, and we have to deal with our problems on the ground. So firefighter safety is a piece of this, and it's going to take policies from both the states and the U.S. Forest Service to address that issue, but we need to be thinking about these things more broadly. We come up with one-off solutions. We come up with very reactive solutions to dealing with not just fires, but all sorts of climate impacts, and we spend tons of money after the fact or during the fact on these things, but really an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure here. So communities, states, the country needs to be thinking more collaboratively and cohesively about how we deal with this year-round fire season, these hotter, drier summers, these fires that are burning bigger and hotter and longer, knowing that they're going to happen. So we need to do things that aren't exactly sexy. We need to look at our building codes. Our cities are encroaching into the forest, as Daniel mentioned earlier. We have this rapid population growth on the West Coast, and that's just adding to the stress. So these things aren't going to be a simple one-off, add more firefighters, spend more money. We really need to be getting down in the weeds and thinking about preparedness and planning for at least the next decade or two, knowing that these summers are going to keep repeating themselves.
Let's take another caller. Let's go to Phil in New Mexico. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. Sorry about the problems. I have a couple of questions for the climate scientists. The main one is, are the climate models showing an increase of extreme events? In other words, is the probability distribution tail getting fatter? The second thing is, if they could talk about polar amplification.
All right, thank you. Kathy, do you want to take that one first?
Yeah, so we know that climate change is increasing extreme events. I think earlier we talked about especially extreme heat events and extreme downpours. We're seeing the tails of the distribution shift in that direction. We're breaking way more warm temperature records than we are cool ones by a massive ratio. So we're seeing that, and we're able to, as Daniel mentioned earlier, attribute some of these events to climate change. We know climate change is making these things more likely. And as I talked about a few minutes ago, we're still surprised by things that happen. So in this changing climate, in this rapidly changing world we're living in, we're going to see extremes pop up either earlier than expected or that we can't necessarily tease out of one model. I'm going to punt the polar question to Daniel. I think he's studied this a little bit more than I have.
Okay, Daniel?
Thanks, Kathy. So, you know, we do see that definitely an increase, not only in the observed extreme events to date with extreme temperatures and downpours, as we've mentioned, but also a much larger increase in climate model simulations for the future, where additional warming, at least some degree of additional warming, is essentially inevitable. We see a much larger increase in extremes. And you mentioned a fattening of the tail or of the distribution. In other words, meaning that there is not just a gradual shift upward, but that the whole shape of the distribution of overall events changes somewhat. And first of all, we don't necessarily have to see a change in the shape of that distribution to see a big increase in extreme events. You can just take essentially your historical distribution of extremes and shift it upward a little bit, and you're going to get a big increase in extremes. But for other kinds of events, for some kinds of events in some regions, it probably will be the case that we will see a fairly fundamental shift in sort of the overall frequency or intensity distribution for certain sorts of extremes. And that's not necessarily a statement we can make generally for all types of extremes everywhere in the world. But what is quite clear in general is that, you know, the frequency and intensity of heat waves, that's already a done deal. We're already in the future where that's occurring in front of our eyes. Same thing with big downpours. But what may start to happen is we may see that sort of signal start to emerge for other things too. We've already starting to see it emerge for droughts, for example. And we may start to see it in the future for things like hurricane intensity or the intensity of atmospheric river storms along the west coast of North America, which are so critical. So we still think there are other sorts of extreme events that will begin to increase in a really identifiable and clear way as the climate continues to warm. And that's partly due to projections from climate models, but it's also partly just due to theoretical expectations. And so far, for the kinds of events that we have seen changes in the real world, all of these three things line up: the observations, the climate model simulations, and the deeper sort of climate science theory. And I'm trying to remember what the second portion of that question was. That's right, it was about the Arctic. It is definitely true that we are seeing rapid warming in the Arctic that is greatly outpacing the warming elsewhere on the planet. We've mentioned that roughly globally we've warmed about a degree so far, but the Arctic has already warmed 3 or 4 degrees, and that's a ratio of warming. The fact that they're warming about 3 times faster than the rest of the world is something that we expect to continue. So for 2 or 3 degrees of global warming, that means anywhere from 6 to 9 or more degrees of warming in the Arctic, and that's a tremendous amount of warming, especially in a place that is so sensitive to temperature, because, of course, there's a lot of ice in the Arctic in the form of both sea ice and land ice on the Greenland ice sheet, for example. And, you know, aside from the obvious reasons why it's important, which is that warmer temperatures melt a lot of that ice, there are some potentially indirect consequences, too, where what happens in the Arctic is not necessarily going to stay in the Arctic, because the weather patterns here at lower latitudes, in the middle latitudes on Earth, are affected by what's going on in the far north. And we're still trying to figure out exactly the nature of that connection, but it's pretty clear it's going to be important. But it's hard to say right now exactly when and where and to what degree.
Well, thank you again for the call, Phil. We have time for one more caller. Let's go to Wayne in San Mateo. Hi, Wayne.
Hello. Thank you very, very much for this program. First, I'd like to thank the scientists for a level of honesty about what the change will be when we go to 2 degrees Celsius or 3 degrees Celsius, and that this is not a new normal. This is a progression that is going at a rapid pace beyond whatever carbon dioxide has been emitted in history. The rate at which we're emitting carbon dioxide now, 10 gigatons per year, is unparalleled at any time in history. I'd like to encourage people to go to the September 8th rally for the climate summit in San Francisco, and there's other rallies around the country. And I really want to keep encouraging the scientists to speak in language like you're speaking now, rather than talking about, well, it's a possibility and it's this. We're in an absolute crisis situation now. If we want to have a planet where people can, where our next generation can live, we need to make changes now. We need to get off fossil fuels now. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that. To that point, Susan wrote in, until our government stops denying the existence of climate change, we are courting disaster. Trump and his supporters are under the influence of conservative science-denying propaganda, and we are all overruled by the powerful fossil fuel industry lobbyists. Final thoughts from you, Kathy, on Wayne's point and Susan's email.
Well, we know that this is the biggest challenge of our generation, and I personally don't want to look back in 30 years and say I didn't speak up because I knew what was happening and it was too sensitive. The government, the federal government right now is pursuing the dismantling of environmental policies that have been in place for decades. But the U.S. isn't the only player on the global stage, and if we're not going to be a leader, then the other big countries will be. China is making progressions in renewables and trying to cut its emissions. We see the states, especially the West Coast states, stepping up in the absence of federal leadership. So it's really easy to throw our hands up and look at some things that are frustrating and say, well, nothing's going to change because these people won't do something. I look to acid rain legislation and how quickly that moved and how we solved a big environmental problem. I think the states right now are carrying the water. I think the states have to. And I know that it's going to be a frustrating process, but I still haven't completely lost hope. I think that we know what we need to do. I still underscore that we are very unprepared for what we're facing right now and in the next decade, and we can't ignore preparedness and resilience and adaptation as well, but there's still time. There's a 1 in 20 chance that we can hit that 2 degrees threshold, which, you know, we know bad things will still happen then, but we need to keep trying and we need to keep moving forward.
And Daniel, what would you add?
Well, I would just add that, you know, I think something I continue to try and emphasize in my conversations these days is really the scope of the climate problem. It is really an enormously vast problem in the sense that solutions really don't stem from individual-level actions. There really is going to have to be a global framework for addressing this very quickly, sooner rather than later. And it is going to involve transformational changes in the way we generate energy and the way we live our lives. And I think some folks conflate those transformational changes with, you know, going back to the Stone Age and not using energy, which is really not what any serious scientist or policymaker has ever suggested. Mm-hmm. It's really just a matter of being willing to account for the damage and the harm that's occurring as a result of global warming when we make economic transactions or when we generate energy. And on the broad scale, these are things that would have a lot of co-benefits from environmental justice and human well-being and environmental well-being perspectives. So these are all things that, you know, are going to have substantial upfront costs, but the benefits are going to be so much larger than the cost that it's clear that it's something that we need to be doing now.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. We will continue following this. Daniel Swain, atmospheric scientist at UCLA, and Kathy Dello, associate director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute at Oregon State. Thank you both for joining us. Thank you so much for your work. And thank you all for joining us. I really apologize for these technical issues. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.